we teach in 10th grade, it's more of a conceptual physics. And the reason we call it physical science is because the last 9 weeks we teach chemistry. So the physical sciences are physics and chemistry. But many of our students do not go into physics. So we feel that we may be the only physics they experience. So we spend 3/4 of our year teaching the concepts of physics. And then the last 9 weeks, because all of our students will go into chemistry, it's just a building, maybe building a foundation for those students to go into that next level of chemistry.
How did you get into that subject?
Well, I have always taught physical science, but my first 10 years, I taught it very traditional. And what I mean by that, mostly lecture, I did most of the talking, maybe incorporate some labs here and there. And then about 10 years into my teaching, a lady named Marla Hines came over from another school and she brought this active physical science curriculum. And it changed my whole viewpoint, my whole world of teaching, because now we do the lab first and then we learn about it. So it's a really neat setup. We use what's called the 5E method. And so any concept I teach, I'd really try to use this 5E method. And you're going to see that in the new science course of study. And this 5E method is the first step is that you want to engage the student. So I'm going to do something to get them hooked. It could be a video. It could be just a big question. It could be throw out some whiteboards and let's see how much you know about the, you know, maybe we're looking at electrical circuits today. Just want to see how much you know about it. So the next step is going to be explore. We're going to jump right into the lab. So I've engaged them, I've gotten them hooked, then we jump right into the lab. So they explore, they go ahead and do the lab, and rather than me teaching, I'm more of a facilitator of learning.
Mm-hmm.
Then after they have explored, let's say circuits, you know, maybe some series and parallel circuits, the next step is going to be to explain it. And what's cool about this step is I don't have to do all of the talking because they've already seen the circuits in action, so they now become a part of the discussion.
Sort of a more collaborative approach.
Absolutely. And so I like to think of myself, because the more I talk, the less they learn. The more they talk, the more they learn. And so you've got engage, explore, now I'm going to explain. And then the next step is you can either call it elaborate or extend. They might need to do some extra problems, draw some circuits, you know, just some things to take what they learned in the lab and what we've talked about and go a little bit further. And then the last step, which you can actually use this at any point, is evaluate. I want to make sure they're learning what they're supposed to learn. So I can evaluate at any step. I can evaluate at every step if I really wanted to. And then what I love about the new course of study, the new science course of study, which is you'll probably start to hear a lot more about, is they've added the 5E and they call it plus IA, which the I stands for intervene. So if there's a student or a couple of students who maybe didn't get what they were supposed to get, or maybe they need a little extra practice, now I can intervene and give them some extra practice. And then the students who are ready to roll, maybe the A stands for accelerate, so they can maybe go over and beyond and learn more than maybe expected about the circuits. It's a really neat little process. And there's a 7E model and a 5E model, but I usually just, the 5E covers it all. So engage, explore, explain, extend, and evaluate.
So how long have you been teaching that way, that sort of new style?
About 6 years.
About 6 years?
Yeah.
And do you find your students, are they more sort of excited about the class?
Yeah. They love it. And what I love is when and that whole process may take 2 days, it may take 4 days, it may take 5 days. It just depends on what the concept we're learning. We'll have them leave class and they're like, golly, that went by so fast. And just, you know, come in the next day, what are we doing today? And that's kind of the culture I want to build in my classroom, where kids are excited about learning, not just excited about science, but they're excited about learning.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that this approach and this kind of excitement sort of factored into your selection as Alabama Teacher of the Year. How did the people at the State Department of Education, how do they know about this? How do they know that this was going on in your classroom?
Well, first step in the process is you get nominated at the school. There's a selection committee and they select a teacher. And There were three things that I kind of had going for me at school. A was this new curriculum, and that's just my entire department. We all use the 5E model. And the second was I had started a guided study program for some at-risk students during study halls, and we'll probably talk about that later. And then the third was this teacher-led instructional rounds that my colleague Marla and I started. And so basically, I was nominated at the school level, and then, of course, you have to write papers. Hey, we're going to nominate you. We think you're doing a great job in your classroom. Oh, by the way, it's going to be a lot of work.
So you're basically writing essays again.
Yes. And, of course, in my essays, one of the one of the questions is, what are your greatest accomplishments? And one of my greatest accomplishments was when I realized the importance of making sure that the students were the center of the learning process, that I'm not the center of the learning process. My job is not necessarily to stand up there and disseminate information. My job is to put them in as many situations where they have opportunities to collaborate with other students, lots of different students, not just their friends, but lots of different, because those are skills that sometimes we forget, that we're not just teaching our specific content area, we're teaching them life skills they're going to take with them to college and in the workplace.
Including how to learn. It's sort of the opposite of an old school sort of, lecture type.
Yeah, so I would refer to my class as more of a student-centered, non-traditional classroom. You're rarely going to see rows. Students are going to be working in collaborative groups. You're going to probably walk in and it's going to be a little bit chaotic. But I would like to think if you sat down with any group of students, you would see that they were really learning and they weren't just goofing off. And that's what I love. I love seeing the kids doing the work because that's when they're learning.
Yeah. Those light bulbs. I was a teacher. The light bulb is the best thing when you see it on their faces.
What did you teach?
I taught. I did a Teach for America assignment, and I taught. I basically taught all subjects, but then towards the second and third year of when I was teaching, I taught mainly math and writing, a little bit of science, but it sort of depended on what the school.
Isn't it fun to just teach kids to love learning?
Yeah, yeah. Really, I mean, just seeing it on their faces is about the most satisfying thing. I guess, this kind of leads into my next question about you. So why did you get into teaching in the first place?
Okay, so I never thought I would be a teacher in high school. That would never cross my mind. In seventh grade, Ms. Freeberg, my science teacher, said, Jennifer, you can be anything you want to be. You can be a rocket scientist if you want to. And in 10th grade, I started my basketball team at my high school, first ever basketball team at Pleasant Grove High School. I pioneered it, and I decided I wanted to be a basketball player. That was all I wanted to do. I loved it. I was obsessed with basketball. I practiced every single day. We were 1-27, I think, that year, but I didn't care. And that was all I wanted to do. And, of Excellent. Course, I love school, too. And when my senior year, I was offered a scholarship to a junior college to play basketball and softball. And it was an academic scholarship as well. And of course, basketball wasn't on the list of majors, so I chose nursing because I'd always thought that I wanted to be a nurse because my aunt and my cousin, they were both nurses.
Where'd you go to school, by the way, college?
I went to Hiwassee Junior College my first year, and I played basketball and softball, and it was difficult. It was difficult playing both sports, even at the junior college level, and frankly, I didn't really enjoy it, and it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And I came back home, and I might have been a little homesick, too. And I came back home, I enrolled in UAB, stayed with nursing, and about halfway through my sophomore year, a friend from my alma mater from Pleasant Grove, he said, hey, I'm coaching a softball team. I know you played. Would you be willing to come in and help? Absolutely. And I just really enjoyed that whole process of teaching softball. And I loved science. And I didn't really love science so much in high school, but in college I had a couple of professors that just were so enthusiastic and just made me realize how much fun science was and how much fun learning was. And I thought, okay, well, I love science. I really enjoy coaching. Talked to my mom about it, and I really didn't make the decision immediately, but I took about a year, and I took classes that would go toward both science and education. I worked with my advisor on that. And I talked to my mom about it, and I just made the decision that I wanted to be a teacher, and it was the best decision I ever made.
That's a great story. When was that?
It was probably at the beginning of my junior year of college. So I was taking anatomy, cell biology, pathophysiology, all of those classes that were science classes, and they were difficult. And I just enjoyed the process.
What are some of the pros and cons of being a teacher today?
I think pros of teaching, definitely you get to do what you love. And I think for most teachers, we're all learners, so we love learning. And we get to spend our days mostly learning. And you get to build relationships and inspire not only your students, but other teachers and your leaders. And most of us are really passionate about our subject, so we love our subject matter. And one great thing I love about teaching is that every year I get to start over and I get to be better than the previous year.
You mean when the new kids come in?
Yeah.
So what advice would you give to young people who are considering, you know, should I be a teacher, should I not be a teacher? What would you tell them?
Go for it. If you love learning and you love your subject matter, I would say go for it. I would tell them that it's going to probably be very difficult the first few years because what we do to new teachers, and this is not right, but we throw them in and it's a sink or swim. And unfortunately, it happens a lot at most schools. And I would say to the new teachers, I would say find the best teachers in the school. Forget about content area. You find the best teachers and you try to spend time in their classrooms and you try to become friends with them because that's where you're going to learn. And I would say don't wait on an administrator to appoint you to be a leader. Be a leader because teachers can be leaders. It doesn't matter if you're a first-year teacher, if you're in your 31st year of teaching. You can be a leader if you're making everyone around you better. And then I would probably share my philosophy with them. And my philosophy is pretty easy. Well, the first two. Single most important thing you can do is build relationships. You have to know your students. And if we're doing all the talking, how do we ever get to know our students? So that goes back to those small groups. I believe in the power of collaboration. I believe that when kids are discussing and talking, they're learning. And when we're doing most of the talking, they may not be learning as much as we would like to think they are. And the second part of my philosophy is just love what you do. Love what you do. Love your subject matter, but most of all, just love teaching. Love learning. And then the third part of my philosophy, and this is the most difficult one, this took me about 10 or 11 years to figure out, but just letting students know that it's okay to make mistakes and to fail and build some opportunities for failure into what you're teaching. You know, one of the first things I tell my students when they walk in is, you will not fail my class. You're going to have to work harder to fail this class to make an F at the end of the year than you would because I'm going to make it so much fun, or I would like to think I'm going to make it so difficult for you to fail, but I want students to have some opportunities to make some mistakes and be okay with that because think about the mistakes we've made as adults. Don't we learn from all of those mistakes? And I think that's a lesson because they just want us to tell me what I need to know so I can make an A. And that's not always what learning is about.
Is there one story or one student that motivates you or makes you proud?
About 5 years ago, I was given the opportunity to help implement a guided study program for students who were at risk of failing. And to be honest with you, I chose to do that because I didn't want to have a regular study because the regular studies, we have 24 kids and they're sometimes very needy, and I wanted to have a fewer number of students, but I could help out more. And I had this one young lady, she was a freshman, and she, it was just rough. She came in, she was in an honors class, and she was failing all of her classes. Her notebook was just, it was so disorganized. And helping her kind of find her place in high school, get organized, and just be that person in her life that she knew she could come to. There's a lady named Rita Pearson, and she talks about every kid needs a champion. And I really wanted to help and be an advocate for her and her teachers, between her and her teachers. And seeing her transformation over the last 3 years, I mean, she is such a little confident kid. She makes A's and B's now. And it was just neat seeing that I could have that much of an impact on the life of a student. And that really changed my thinking. And it made me realize how much influence we can have on the lives of students.
And the flip side, is there a student or a story, you know, something you wish you could take back?
Well, specifically, I can't think of anything specific, but I feel like I had so many missed opportunities over those first 10 years because I spent so much time talking and lecturing that I never took the time, or I didn't take as much time as I needed to get to know students. And I feel like I had so many missed opportunities of really investing in the life of a student. So, yeah, I can't think of anything specific, but I know I missed a lot of opportunities.
Is that kind of close relationship building, is that going to be, in a way, harder for you now? Because you're going to be traveling all over the state. How will your day-to-day role change with this new
distinction? So what we've decided with my school system is I am not going to be in the classroom next year. They're going to have someone, they've hired someone to teach my students. And that was because a few years ago, one of my colleagues was alternate teacher of the year, and she missed about 40 or 50 days, and it was really difficult for her. I remember seeing her. She was up there every night making videos for her students, and it put a lot of pressure on everyone, and she was alternate. And So what we decided is that I am actually going to serve as the instructional coach for the teachers at the school this year. And that's a position we wanted to have at the school anyway, so I get to try it out and just see how it might work at the high school level because we have it at some of our elementary schools, but we've never had it at the high school level.
Interesting. And that's sort of obviously you don't have the day-to-day teaching responsibilities. It's something you can do sort of a little more sporadically while you're traveling. And
right.
What is the State Department of Education going to have you doing?
I met with some of the previous teachers of the year, and basically they said you can be as involved as you want to be. And I may have to sit on some committees. I'll have to attend some schools. But there are some schools I want to visit. I was at a workshop last week, the Shoal Summer Technology Institute, and I hung out with some teachers in Northwest Alabama, and I am so excited about some of the things they're doing in their classrooms. I just want to get to some schools and see what teachers are doing in their classrooms. I really want to visit Winterboro High School, and it's a school in Talladega County, and that's what I told them the first place I want to observe, because they have started this project-based curriculum. They had a real big problem with absences and graduation rate. And they implemented this new project-based learning curricula, I guess, because it's cross-curricular. And, man, their graduation rate has skyrocketed. Their kids are coming to school, and you got to think, why are things changing? And it's because the students probably, I'm guessing, feel like they're a part of a team, and they're a part of something bigger than just going and sitting in a classroom every day. And I just want to see that in action.
Interesting. I don't know if you know, but NPR recently did a big treatment of the fact that the graduation rate nationally has gone way up. But, you know, there are different ways to get those numbers up. Some of them are sort of show a lot of hard work and initiative and actually getting involved with students. And some of them are a little bit more like sort of statistical massaging, we'll call it. It's interesting that you bring that up. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, on the emphasis on raising graduation rates and some of the methods that are being used, not necessarily just in Alabama, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know about methods being used, but I think the single most important thing a teacher can do is make sure every student who walks through his or her door feels like they're an important part of the classroom. And when they feel like they're loved and cared about, they're going to be more likely to come to school, because more students than you realize, the teacher is such an important part of their day and school is such an important part of their day. But when you go through every day and you feel like, you know, you're just another number at the school, then sometimes other things can become a priority.
Speaking of that, do you know Gear Up Alabama is a huge federal grant program that's coming? Well, there's one in Birmingham that's separate, but then there's another statewide grant. It's a U.S. Department of Education thing that's sort of designed to get kids, expand their horizons, get them thinking about going to college, getting them to see that there's a larger world out there besides, you know, the small town where they may be living and haven't ever left. Do you know anything about the Gear Up program?
I don't know anything about the Gear Up program, but again, I was at the Shoals Summer Technology Institute last week at Northwest Shoals Community College, and what I loved seeing is how many technical programs there are out there, and that it's not just about making sure kids are ready to go to a four-year college or even a two-year college, making sure that students are aware that there are so many needs in careers like welding, in careers that we may not even think about. We visited the Browns Ferry Nuclear Power Plant, and wow, that was amazing. We visited Lock Dam up there. We visited the community college. I was only there for 2 days, but it was such an enlightening experience, because I think we as teachers, sometimes we feel like we need to say four-year college, two-year college, and college may not be best for every student. And there are careers out there that may only take, you know, a year of technical training, and I think we need to also think about some of those type of careers and the message we're sending. We're preparing students for college and career. That's our job. And I think that Gear Up program, I'll have to do some reading on that, but I think it's great. Any kind of program that we can do to make sure students are college and career ready is a win.
You mentioned a couple times at-risk students. You know, a lot of people out there might be hearing, Vestavia, at-risk students, how many are there really? Are there a lot of at-risk students in Vestavia Hills? And B, do you ever feel like, you know, someone with your talents might have a greater impact in a community that sort of needs you more?
I have thought about that. Yes, but my work at Vestavia, I'm so grateful for the opportunity I have because, first of all, in my science class, most of my students, just being honest, most of my students come into my class and they don't like science. And what a great opportunity it is for me to share my love of science and get them in the mindset that science is actually really cool and it's more than just science. It's about just learning as well. You ask about the at-risk students. We have a large number of students who, I think everybody has this perception that Vestavia is this school where we have no problems, where every kid makes A's, and that's not the case. We have a lot of kids who move in from other schools. We have a lot of single-parent homes. We're just like any other school. It's just that sometimes we have the perception you talked about is because we do win. We win in athletics, we win math team, but that's only a small portion of our students.
Interesting. So perception doesn't quite meet reality, huh?
No.
A lot of teachers say that's true when it comes to teaching, the teaching profession in general. Do you have any thoughts on that, on how teachers are perceived?
That's a difficult question because I feel like, just from the feedback I've gotten from parents, that they just want their kids to learn. And if you provide that learning environment for their students, and their students are coming home talking about your class at the dinner table, you've won. And parents really appreciate that. So, of course, teaching is like any other profession. There are some good teachers, and there are some not so good teachers. And I think sometimes we get judged by the not so good teachers. And we're just like any other profession.
Let's get into some of the more right or wrong, the more controversial topics. And you're an informed person. You've actually stood in a classroom and done that job for many, many years. And you know a lot of teachers, you know students, you know parents, you know administrators. So your sort of take on these things is valuable to our listeners. Do you have any thoughts, general or specific, about the Alabama College and Career Ready standards? In other words, the sort of common core-based standards that our state uses now?
Well, I'm not a math teacher, so I have not taught the College and Career Ready standards. I love the analogy Allison used in an interview with you. She actually compared it to a basketball court and NBA players and how the basketball court was always going to be the same, going to be the same dimensions, going to have the goal was going to be the same height, but how the coach and the players executed the game was going to be different every single day. And I love that analogy because they're just standards. It's not a curriculum. And what I have seen with my 10th graders, as far as math is concerned, is they hate math. They hate math, and if I don't let them use a calculator, they don't want to do it. I have a really hard time getting them to just estimate and just use some mathematical reasoning and really just do math in their head. And what I love about the time I've spent with teachers on their Common Core or College and Career Ready math is that the College and Career Ready math is teaching students to think a little bit differently about math and kind of do it in their head. I think that's important because I see why my students, they don't like math because they don't understand the math sometimes. And that's frustrating. So from some of the teachers I've talked to, I've interviewed a lot of teachers and asked them what their thoughts are on the College and Career Ready standards for math. And some of them like them and some of them just don't want to change what they've been doing for years. And I think they would, you know, some of the teachers would be surprised that they're probably actually doing what they're asked to do, but they don't realize it sometimes.
So even teachers, I mean, it's a lot to ask very busy people to read all those standards.
Right.
I read them once a long time ago. I mean, even teachers don't necessarily even know what's in those standards.
Sometimes, yes.
Okay. Now, Alabama's, it's already done legally, but Alabama, not this coming school year, but the following school year, may very well have charter schools for the first time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
As far as charter schools are concerned, I've heard positives about charter schools. I've heard negatives about charter schools. My stance on charter schools is that I've never stepped foot in a charter school. I've never once even been in a charter school. And it's unfair for me to say anything good or bad about a charter school when I've never actually stepped foot in one. I've only talked to two teachers. One teacher loved it, one teacher hated it. So I feel like sometimes we make these claims about charter schools and we really don't know what they're about. And here's my question. Here's what I would say to anyone who is thinking about starting a charter school here in Alabama? Is it best for the students in that area? That's the first question. Is that what's best? And then, is it also best for the students of Alabama? Because it's going to impact the students of Alabama as well. And so that needs to be the number one question. Is it best for students?
When you said it'll impact the students of Alabama, you mean by siphoning money out of the public kitty, so to speak?
Yes.
Do you think kids today are, do you think there's too much emphasis on standardized testing?
Not in Alabama. I don't think so in Alabama. I love what we do with our standardized testing. I love that we're using the ACT because, again, it goes back to those college and career ready standards. Yes, I don't want to tell a student that college is the only way, but the fact that every student in the state of Alabama gets to take the ACT once when they may not have been able to do that before, who knows? What if they score a great score on the ACT and they get a scholarship to a college and that opens up a door that they may not have had before? I love that we're using the ACT as our standard for testing, but it's not about, I don't feel like it's a high stakes. I don't feel like my job depends on how well my students do on the ACT.
Are there teachers in Alabama who feel that way? I know in other states they do.
I don't think other teachers in Alabama feel that way.
Do you think education is, you know, everybody talks a good game about we care about the future and the children, but in the state of Alabama, which has some of the lowest property taxes of any state in the country, and it's usually number one in that area, if you want to call it that, do you think that the state government, the citizens, the voters, do you think that the state of Alabama prioritizes education enough when it comes to basic funding?
That's a difficult question because I think in their minds they probably want to, but we will never. I don't know if we will ever have enough money to truly fund education because teachers are underpaid, classroom sizes are huge, many schools are underfunded, and one of the problems I see with the way we're going and what we expect teachers to do in the classroom is more of the facilitator of learning rather than the teacher, the disseminator of information. That's really difficult to do when you have 30 or 40 kids in a class. And I've talked to teachers in schools at science conferences, and they say, I have 35 students in my class. How am I expected to carry out these labs and have students work in collaborative groups? And it is tough. Now, I always say you need to do it anyway and find a way, and I know you can do this. But when our classroom sizes are huge, it's really difficult to help and make sure we get to know and really teach every student.
Understood. John Archibald of the Birmingham News and AL.com and sometimes WBHM contributor just wrote a column criticizing the Vestavia Hills school system's mascot, the Rebel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. I read that this morning, and I can see how it is offensive to others. Now, within our school, I don't personally see students taking or using that to be offensive. I think it's just a part of our tradition, but as you know, tradition sometimes can hold you back. And I started with my colleague, we started a system of teacher-led instructional rounds at our school last year. And she wanted to call it pedagogical rounds, in which, you know, I was like, Marla, we want people to join. And so we were working with our assistant principal, and she said, why don't we call it Rebel Rounds? And so we referred to it as Rebel Rounds. No big deal. I mean, everybody was going to join Rebel Rounds. And in my Teacher of the Year papers and in some of my one of the things I've been working with other schools is how to start a system of teacher-led instructional rounds at your school.
When you say instructional rounds, just clarify that for our listeners, instructional rounds.
Our teachers give up one planning period a month, and they observe other teachers. Sometimes the best professional development is right in your school. And so we have created this system of instructional rounds. We wanted it to be like medical rounds at a hospital. You walk in, you observe someone, see what they're doing in your class, you leave, you kind of talk about it. What did you see? How can you use that? Go to another teacher, observe them, do the same thing, and then we kind of write it up on a shared Google Doc. And so I've been sharing that with other schools, but I'm very careful that I don't refer to it as Rebel Rounds because I'm worried that it might offend someone. Because if they don't know our mascot is the Rebel, what are they thinking that Rebel Rounds are? So I can see that from an outsider looking in, but I don't feel like personally our students use that in any negative manner. And I would be okay with changing it.
Would you favor it, or you're sort of neutral on that?
I would favor.
Speaking of controversial topics, do you have any opinions on the whole Jamie Blair situation with the contract that he was given to basically sort of stay home and getting more money than anyone else in the system but not working actually in his office in the system?
I do not.
Okay. Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know? Anything that maybe I should have asked you and didn't? Anything I might have forgotten? Anything else at all that you think our listeners should know?
You know, the five big things that I want to come out in interview in any interview is the importance for teachers to not only teach their content, but to teach the students the love of learning and really make sure that they're active participants and they're creating a student-centered as opposed to a teacher-centered environment. And I want teachers to know that they can empower other teachers. And okay. that can take many forms. We chose to do it with our instructional rounds, and we have over half of our faculty involved in our instructional rounds, and it was really neat. And then just want teachers to know that what they do every day matters. The little things, standing at the door, greeting students, getting to know students, you know, even sometimes just putting a smiley face on a kid's paper just for doing well and saying, hey, keep up the good work, and really praising their effort sometimes over their intelligence will really make a difference. And I love what Tammy Dunn, she was a teacher of the year. I don't know what year she was, but she said a teacher on her feet is worth three in her seat. And I love that because it reminds us of the importance of our job and really just making sure we're getting around. And again, goes back to making sure we're facilitating learning and we're in with those groups and making sure that we get to know every student.
I mean, it really is. I don't think people realize this. You have to know the content area, but it's a hard thing to measure and it's a hard thing to teach. And I've always struggled with this. Can you really teach someone to be a great teacher? And you can always, wherever you start from, you can always get better. But a lot of it is this really ethereal, personal connection that you have
personal
with the students.
Personal connection, yes. And I believe, I was presenting at the UAB's Mid-South Conference the other day, the Reading and Writing Conference. And I was talking about opening closed doors. And that was the message. But in opening closed doors, the message I wanted them to understand is I had them take a personality test. And we do this, it's called a True Colors test. There are lots of different personality tests, but this is called True Colors. And there are four colors. Golds, they're usually kind of organized, check-in-the-box type people. Your greens are your innovative, curious, why. Those are the students that just, I mean, they bring innovation to society. Your oranges, they just want to have fun. So they come in the class, and if it's a fun day, they're going to learn. And then your blues kind of bring unity to society. They're the nurturers. They're the ones that need that smiley face on their paper to know that, hey, my teacher cares about me. And seeing I had the teachers take that personality test, and many teachers end up being golds. And many teachers end up being that check-in-the-box type person, schedule. We forget that most of our class doesn't learn the way we learn. And so we try to put these greens in that checkbox, and the greens' brain doesn't fit in that checkbox. And just getting them to understand that they've got to have a lot of different strategies to reach every single student. And not only do they have to deal with diverse learning styles and personalities, they have to deal with diverse abilities. And I use this ladder, and it has I did, I will, I can, what is it at the bottom is I can't, I won't. It's like 10 things. And I use this example. I say, all right, who in here, all right, I'm going to give you a topic, and where do you fall on the ladder? And I always use a half marathon. And so I have one or two who are the I dids, one or two who are I will, a lot of I won'ts and I can'ts, and I think I might. And I want them to see that that's how their classroom is. With every different content, with every different topic they teach, you're going to have kids that are at different places on that ladder. And how can you get those students to work together? And if that was our main job is to run that marathon, that half marathon, if that was going to be our grade, how would I get you guys to do that? And we would all work together to make sure I paired some of the ideas with the I wills and blah, blah, blah. And it's really neat for them to see that every student learns differently and everybody is wired differently. So how do I have this toolbox full of instructional strategies to reach every student? Well, I've got to collaborate with other teachers. And that's why we wanted to start that system of instructional rounds so we could really see what we could learn from other teachers. And it was really neat because I see a lot of teachers, you know, instructional rounds only work if it's teacher-led. If an administrator tells you have to do it, you're going to see it as threatening. But when it's teachers working together to learn from each other, it becomes non-threatening and it becomes a true learning experience for teachers. And it's really fun to see teachers growing right alongside their students.
It sounds like what you do you've sort of been doing this for a while. Now that you're teacher of the year, you may have a sort of a bigger microphone, more opportunities to do this. But it sort of sounds like you're trying to not just students, but get teachers to step back a little bit and kind of reorder their thinking about what they do every day.
Yes. And I've had a lot of interviews with students. I interview my students often because when I started learning and becoming a better teacher, I guess, was when I started asking students, why do you like Coach Davis? Oh, my gosh, he does this, this, and this. Why do you like Miss Dressback? Oh, she does this, this, and this. I wanted to do that, that, and that. I wanted to be that person. And so I just started learning, and I was like, hey, I heard my student said you do this really cool thing called a fishbowl in your class. This is Miss Dalton. She's an English teacher. I want to observe that. She was like, absolutely, come on. And it was just so much fun. I started observing other teachers and seeing what they were doing in their class. And I'll be honest, it was because I was I had gone back to school to get my master's in instructional leadership, and this was a part of my action research paper, is the impact of a student-centered learning environment. So I was seeking out teachers who were creating that type of environment. And it was like, wow, we have some great teachers at this school. Why are we not sharing this with others?